So Leland, we've had two big traffic spikes since we started Best Rumored from the Future.
Well, the first was when we talked about Pioneer One, an awesome little crowdsourced show. The second, when we posted a picture of Deadpool in a maid's outfit.
So we're calling this episode, "You Guys Want Deadpool in a Maid's Outfit? Fine, here it is."
Welcome to Vestrymen from the Future, Season 2, Episode 1.
It's gonna be the future soon. I won't always be this way. When the things that make me weak and strange get engineered away. It's gonna be the future soon. Never seen it quite so clear. When my heart is breaking, I can close my eyes. It's already.
What are we starting with?
Let's do them in the order we talked about.
Okay.
A Silk Spectre sandwich.
Oh, okay. That sounds sounds
awesome.
Like a good time.
Yeah.
So, welcome to Vestrymen from the Future, Relaunch Episode 1. We're calling it the relaunch because we have not actually produced one of these in quite some time.
It might be a year. It might be longer than the original run.
Yeah, we're not actually sure. Anyway, but we're back, and we're back with a new, shorter format for all of those who complained that listening to us discuss comic books for 2 hours was difficult for you to get through.
You just don't love us the way you should.
No, probably not, or we're not nearly as entertaining as we think we are. Anyway, we'd like to kick this off with quick reviews of 4 new pamphlets that we picked up at the comic book store down the street this week. We're going to kick that off with a book called Star Wars Darth Maul Death Sentence. Cable, what did you think of this book?
It was the best Star Wars book, comic book I've ever read, which is a ridiculously low bar. It was entertaining. I didn't give a crap about any of the characters.
I tend to agree. At the end of this book, the editor writes this article about how he is bothered by the fact that comic book readers don't tend to read Star Wars comic books. It's mostly Star Wars fans who read Star Wars comic books. And I would say that I can understand why. This book actually, I think, is a good comic book, not just a good Star Wars comic book. And if you have any interest in the content or the source material, if you really wanted to know more about Darth Maul, sure, go for it. Whatever.
I diverge from you. I mean, on a scale of Bugman to Superman, I'd give it the Starman of 1951.
Okay, on a scale from Superman down to Chris Sims, I give it a I Dream of Jeannie.
Okay, mediocre. If you're into Star Wars, pick it up.
Okay, on to Before Watchmen, Silk Spectre 1 and 2. Let's talk about these separately, because they're super different.
Sure.
Silk Spectre 1, 2 sentences about this book. I think it's predictable. I think it fails to tell us anything new about the character. I like Darwin Cook. I do not like this pamphlet. It does nothing for me.
The art's nice, actually, I think. But, no, if you've read Watchmen, you don't gain anything new from Silk Spectre 1.
I think we're both on the same page there. It's just, it's not a great book. He's setting up for other things, but we could probably throw this issue in the trash and start with Silk Spectre number 2.
I really liked this book, actually.
Why did you like this book?
It's set in a fictional 60s, which is like the 60s written so large it hurts. You've got this innocent but girl learning about the world who's also incredibly talented, funny, and interesting, set against colorful, larger-than-life villains.
I like it, too. The first 3/4 of the book felt extremely goofy and extremely campy to me. Like, this setup on this book is very Scooby-Doo.
Yes.
And the style of the book is pretty much the same. It's just super hippy-dippy. Oh my, coming of age in the 60s. And I think Darwin Cook probably knows something about coming of age in the 60s. And I think he obviously likes the subject matter. The bad guy in this book is so, so silly. but all of a sudden, the last 4 or 5 pages of this book, it gets super dark. Like,
well, in the opening's super,
the opening's pretty dark, but the last 5 pages of this book take this major turn down the,
oh,
holy
yeah,
shit, stuff just got real, which I liked. So I'm actually pretty excited about issue 3 of this run.
Yeah, Yeah, me too.
I'm going to give that a thumbs up. So let's move on.
Star Trek Doctor Who, Leland.
This book is clearly a book that we bought because the cover is a Cyberman menacing Captain James T. Kirk. Well, Tom Baker's Doctor Who and Spock look on. I cannot describe to you how compelling this is to me.
It speaks to us in a fundamental way. The book is... I'm not sure if it's good or if it's bad, but I will tell you it's insane.
It's totally insane. I don't think I will read another one. This is 3 out of some number. I just don't even care.
And Rory, like, show up on page 20 of a 22-page comic book and act like they've been there the whole time.
Nothing about this makes any sense. None of the Star Trek characters are written particularly Star Trek-y.
No.
This is just a weird, weird idea. It's...
I mean, the idea is, I think, probably pretty defensible.
I mean, so the Borg and the Cybermen are basically the same.
Pretty similar,
So,
whatever. No, but I mean, I think that there's a compelling argument for Tom Baker's Doctor Who looks a lot like... looks a lot like the old Star Trek. And we're out of time for quick reviews.
Yep.
Buy this if you want your brain to cook.
I'm going to give that a thumbs down. We're going to take a really short break, and we'll be back to talk about the first issue, graphic novel from James Robinson's Starman.
He shoots his cuffs, now he's headed downtown, picks up one life, puts another one down, and his body hums, and the music's playing, dance, Sidereus Johnson, dance, it's a cold world.
Starman, volume 1 of the graphic novels.
This is a book that Cable picked up like a year ago to read on the bus. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't know anything about this character when we went into this. It's not as if Starman is one of your typical household name superheroes. So what do we know about Starman?
Starman, there have been more Starman than you care to count. The first one was Ted Knight. He was a Golden Age member of the All-Star Winners Squad, and then later the...
He was created in 1941, and I cannot remember who his creator is. It's unimportant.
Yeah, and it's unmentioned.
He's a very typical Golden Age
hero. More powered up than most Golden Age heroes. His gravity and cosmic rods are ridiculously named and powerful.
I'm going to chuckle a little bit every time on this podcast that we say cosmic rod. It's maybe the best superhero tool ever invented.
Well, if you're going to have juvenile fantasies, they might as well have a cosmic rod.
Indeed, they might as well.
But he's... he's got a higher power level, but he never really seems to notice.
Yeah, he's just in the 40s, he's a scientist type story. He has invented something cool that gives him some powers, and he goes out and fights injustice.
So the two ways he's unique as a Golden Age hero is he's not a district attorney, and he's not at all aerobic. Yes, he doesn't have any gymnastic style tools in his belt.
Nope, just a cosmic rod.
Yeah. In his belt. Alright,
So other things happened with Starman for a while, and then there was this. A guy named James Robinson got to write a relaunching, basically, of an old Golden Age hero in the post-crisis DC universe. And suddenly there was an excellent book.
James Robinson, up till now, had mostly done fill-in work on pretty notable stuff. I mean, he'd written Batman, he'd written Superman. He'll go on after this to write a pretty influential run on Superman. But coming into this, he'd done very little.
And I think this is the type of thing that actually, this sort of work is what makes a lot of writers' careers in comic books. You get given a character where there's continuity that you've got to work with, but nobody really cares what you do with them. There's not the same scrutiny on a Starman run as there is on a Superman or a Batman run.
I mean, even a Green Lantern or a Flash.
You're pretty much allowed to do whatever you want with this character. And I think this is one of those instances where a pretty solid writer takes a character who he obviously really likes and is into, and takes that character in actually a really cool, exciting direction. We'll get more into that in the second part of the podcast. But basically, I think at this point, we can probably point to this as James Robinson's opus work. If you want to read...
This or the JSA run he did right after it.
Yeah, but this is excellent and really an example of a guy writing a story that you can tell that he is just... really, really loves.
He created a protagonist that was everything he loves about the world, I think. Well, except for he's kind of a dick, but...
I think that that's even likable. I mean,
We'll get
more into that. Tony Harris, the art penciler on this.
He literally has not a single comic book credit before this book.
Which is... not unheard of for someone to come out of left field and
especially
do something
on a
awesome.
Like D-level book. Like
But this, as good as the writing on this book is, and as interesting as you know where this came from in its sort of how this relates to other comics that were happening at the time. Yeah, there was a lot of this actually, kind of in post-crisis.
Most of it was not
DC.
This good,
and this is surprisingly good for a period where DC was dusting off a lot of crap.
Yes.
But Tony Harris does just awesome art in this book.
It's unique. It's not derivative, especially in this time period. No one was drawing like this, right?
Yeah,
he doesn't look anything like Rob Liefeld.
Yes. Well, and it just feels, I don't know, very, very evocative. It's stylistic, but it manages to hold on to the realism. It just communicates an awful lot.
And he's got a great range from like super from these like super close detailed character sketches to these
like big bold black heavily shaded like really almost noir moments in this book. Really, really cool stuff.
Where you basically you get these iconic just back shots of people with lightning so Opal City is supposed to be an Art Deco city with a modern sheen on it, and
we've never seen that before.
That's never happened.
DC comic book city ever. It's a little bit Gotham like.
It is, but it doesn't feel like Gotham to me ever looking at it.
So if Gotham is, we tend to think of that as like a deco or a gothic city. And Metropolis as kind of the city of tomorrow. Opal, I think, sits somewhere in between. It's kind of it's a city with a dark heart and a very polished, artificial bubble on top of it. Kind of.
I'm not even quite sure it's artificial. I think it's got a lot of class.
It's definitely a classy city. This feels like the type of city where people go to a lot of gallery openings.
Yeah, but not in Gotham. They go to gallery openings because they dig gallery openings. In Gotham, they go to gallery openings because, you know, society
In Gotham, they do these sorts of things because there's an enormous class rift in Gotham that we're constantly being reminded of. I mean, it's basically
it's one of the
core... things about Gotham City is there's a class war in Gotham City. I didn't get that feeling from Starman at all. I don't think that this book has much interest in discussing the haves and have-nots.
No, it's rather than like having a class war, it's clearly... and this is all done through art, which is why it's interesting.
Yeah,
it's clearly a city where there's funky record stores on the corner.
Yeah.
And Parisian...
It's just cool. Opal is this... weird cosmopolitan city that For some reason, I imagine it existing in this improbable alternate present version of Arizona. And I could not tell you why.
See, I was thinking it basically sits right on top of Seattle. It's just like the superhero version of Seattle. Seattle's its secret identity.
It doesn't feel like Seattle to me. No. Though the architecture feels a little bit like Seattle.
Well, and the like hipster nature of it.
The reason we're talking about this in the first section is that this comes back to Tony Harris, this relatively unknown guy. He's done a really kick-ass job of creating this place that's not part of the broader DC geography that I think of, really.
No, I mean, it's not any of the DC fictopolises.
Yeah, so
that you really think of.
It's cool, and I think it's mostly cool because of Tony Harris.
Yeah, and he does a lot in this first arc to tell you a ton about the city, just in the art.
Yeah, it's great. Basically, mechanically, a really solid team working on this book. Do you know anything about why this book, this run, got written?
Well, first off, because James Robinson made a great pitch for it, I think, was one. And two, DC was at this point looking to redefine their universe. They were trying a lot of stuff. If you could bring them a compelling story that they thought would sell well, they'd headline it. They also kind of, I think, thought it was more adult following Watchmen.
Yeah.
There was a market for this stuff.
I think there's Watchmen definitely a Watchmen-esque flavor to the character, not to the characters in the book, but to the character of the production on this
book.
It's
like someone took the more optimistic sections of Watchmen, distilled them, pulled out all the awesome, and made a book almost. Yeah. Like,
Starman, basically a success story of DC's post-crisis period, when there are so many unsuccessful stories.
Yeah.
We'll take another quick interlude and we'll be back to actually talk about what happens inside of this book.
My secret lair on Skullcrusher Mountain. I hope that you've enjoyed your stay so far. I see you've met my assistant Scarface. His appearance is quite disturbing, but I assure you he's harmless enough. He's a sweetheart, calls me master, and he has a way of finding pretty things.
Okay, and we're back to talk about what's inside, in between the covers of Starman, Starman Volume 1.
I think we spoiled it a little bit in the first section. We liked this book.
Yeah, I don't think that's a spoiler. Actually, speaking of spoilers, the quick disclaimer is that the common ground of the next 10 minutes is that if you wanted to read this book unspoiled, you should probably not listen to us talk about it.
Yes.
Of housekeeping be out of the way.
We're going to try to confine our conversation to the first story arc in the omnibus, the first graphic novel.
To be fair, I don't remember exactly where that ends. I mean, the way these omnibus editions are laid out, there are like, I don't know how many volumes are actually in here. Probably
about four or five.
Yeah. So I think I know where the first one ends, but I read this a while ago. So we may actually get a little bit into volume two. Who cares?
Read those before you listen.
This book starts out with one of the three Starman characters that we will actually be introduced to in this volume.
No, we were introduced to five Starman.
Is it
characters.
Five in the first volume?
Yeah.
Because I thought the other ones came in,
no,
in
as
volume
a, the,
two.
Two come in as an epilogue to the first volume. You meet them and you're told that they're in bad situations.
Gotcha. So basically, Ted Knight, Theodore Knight, if you prefer overwrought names, is...
Or Teddy Knight, if he wants to have an awesome mustache.
Is an aging scientist who used to be a superhero. His son, Jack Knight, is a guy who owns a store that sells retro stuff and collectibles.
He's called a junk dealer.
Yeah, but he basically owns a retro store. He's obsessed with the past. He's a comic book geek. He's definitely not a superhero. His brother, David, is and has been groomed from a young age, we're kind of told, to be the next Starman. Ted Knight has decided that he needs a legacy and the world needs a Starman. So,
well, and I think it's legitimate in the DC universe to decide your city probably needs at least one superhero.
All DC metropolises need at least one superhero. So David Knight is out being Starman, and he's very...
new.
Yeah, he's relatively new. He actually had a run as Starman in other books.
In Starman Volume 1, yeah. Which ends when this volume begins. Yeah. When this book begins.
But he's...
we're not told much about his family.
Yeah, we don't know a whole lot about David... actually at all, because within the first 5 pages of this book, David poses in an overwrought fashion on a clock tower and gets shot in the chest.
Thinking about how awesome it is to be a superhero.
Yeah.
Bullet through the chest.
Clearly he forgets about the downside of superheroes, and that is that people called the Mist want to orchestrate convoluted plots to kill you.
Yes. Although this one is in fairness not that convoluted.
No.
We shot you with a bullet.
So, within the first 5 pages, David Knight is dead, and there is no active Starman. At this point, Ted Knight brings his other son in, and we find out that David Knight was never supposed to be Starman. He just became Starman because the son who was actually groomed to be the superhero is...
Kind of a dick.
Yeah, and has completely rejected this idea. He wants to have a store and wear leather jackets.
And be
like
awesome.
Yeah.
Get tattoos.
You know, he just wants to be this rad bohemian guy.
Well, and he and his dad clearly have had a bunch of problems.
Indeed. So, maybe not the most original setup for a reluctant hero type of story. But the shit hits the fan really fast.
Well, and I hate both of them for significant sections of this arc, which I think... But I hate them in a good way, right? They're both clearly good guys. Not good guys in a comic book sense, but, like, decent human beings who just have trouble... They're a father and son who have trouble relating to each other.
Yeah, well, and David, who's now dead, clearly fits into this also. There's really, really... intense themes of sibling rivalry here, of what are my parents' expectations, what do I want to do, how much control do I want to exert over my life. It's kind of like Silk Spectre issue 1, except not stupid.
So awesome. Well, I mean, one thing is, in the first 4 pages, someone gets shot through the chest. You're not going to be bored.
No, it's... And the character is... just comes out swinging as this really interesting character. Ted Knight, the old Starman, is clearly this father figure who has no concept of why people are rejecting his ideas about what they should be doing.
No.
It's just so
like
obvious.
A golden age superhero would be.
It's so obvious to him that if you have the ability to try to save the world, you have to. You don't have a choice. You better prepare for it, because it's on you, buddy.
yeah, and even more than that, you've got the last name Knight.
Exactly. And he's obsessed with the fact that he's able to pass on this legacy. Which I guess... I mean, I think the way he sees it is much like a very wealthy family getting ready to pass on money to a child. The assumption would be, we have all this money... It's never even crossed our minds once that you wouldn't want it. I think Ted Knight is the same way here. I have a cosmic rod and this legacy as the protector of Opal City. I can't even understand why my sons would not want to capitalize on
this. Right. It's more like, how and when are you going to take it? Not like...
How and when are you going to take my cosmic rod?
In fairness, this first volume, there are so many fucking cosmic and gravity pieces. There's a gravity belt that apparently Skyman wore in the 40s, and two cosmic rods and a gravity rod.
Superhero naming conventions were really, really on the nose in the 40s, weren't they?
Yes, there was nowhere else for them to go. Like they were just being built.
Yeah, I guess, but we've got Starman, who is called Starman because he harnesses the powers of the cosmos with his stick. But presumably mostly because he can fly around in the sky. There was another gravity-defying superhero who used similar technology called Sky...
He's Skyman, but actually he used Ted Knight's technology. Yeah. Ted made him a belt. Let's talk about the Mist.
Ah, the villains in this book.
Okay, so there's the Mist and the Shade, who actually they give us a wink and a nod that these guys could be easily confused with each other.
And they are...
Well, the Shade is awesome, and the Mist is actually just pretty much your standard... I mean, he calls Ted Knight at one point and goes, ha ha ha, I've taken your science and both your sons away from you.
One of the most awesome things about this book is that they manage to have these villains who deliver these really cliched, like, I'm a Golden Age villain. I have overwrought plots that really seem to have no purpose but my own vanity and maybe money. I have...
No, the Mist doesn't even want money. Yeah, he gives it away willy-nilly.
I have an army of henchmen who are basically faceless goons who follow my every whim because I'm a supervillain and I have an army of henchmen. We're okay. We can go a little bit long.
Okay.
But the thing that's cool about it is that it actually works. You actually buy that these supervillains... Maybe they're crazy, maybe something else is going on, but their motives don't seem forced to me at all.
No, I mean, the Shade, and the Mist are the people. The Mist is clearly going senile and looking for something to hold on to by the end, and what he's decided to hold on to is this overwrought, pretty destructive plot.
Well, because he hates Ted Knight, he's a really, actually, a great foil for... the ideology that Jack Knight is trying to wrestle with. Really cool villains. And one of the most interesting things about them is throughout the entire book, I never quite figure out what their power sets are.
Nobody!
Like, they don't seem to have well-defined powers. These are not supervillains that are defined by the fact that they can manipulate something or have super strength or even are really smart. They're not like Lex Luthor. I'm wealthy and intelligent. And
no, the Mist is just basically has the time to sit down and talk to
people. Yeah, but he clearly has powers.
Yeah.
What are they? I don't know.
He's got a body that's mostly made out of mist,
I
think.
It's really weird. And pretty cool, because you end up just not focusing on it at
all.
Yeah,
I mean, it's mostly about his character.
Which is on the other end of the spectrum here, Starman's powers are really not very well defined in this book. He's got a cosmic rod that can make him do things. We know he can fly. We know he can shoot some energy out.
He might have some defensive applications.
Yeah, we don't know.
But we don't care.
But this manages to be a superhero story that's got very little to do with superpowers, very little to do with superheroes, more to do with people making the decisions for how hard they're going to be in a bad situation. Kind of Die Hard-esque, actually.
With better... character relationships than Die Hard, because Die Hard's character relationship is I'm gonna kill all you fuckers.
Yeah, like, it's really good. We said we'd talk for 10 minutes. I think we can stop talking.
You should
go buy this book.
You should buy the omnibus. It's hard to get hold of.
It's getting re-released in paperback like
today.
Yeah, like, right around the corner.
No, actually, the first volume's out in paperback.
Okay,
go buy the first volume.
Yeah, volume omnibus. It's reasonably priced. It's a very, very cool book. It's the type of book you can have on your shelf and you can feel special that you have something that...
It's really it's from a unique moment in time. It's really powerful.
A kick-ass piece of DC history here.
And The Shade may be one of the best... anti-heroes around. He's so much fun.
It's good.
Yeah.
read it. That's all we're going to say this week. Thank you for listening to The Vestrymen from the Future. What are we talking about next week?
We don't know.
Yeah, we know what we're talking about next week. We're talking about a Namor book.
Oh, yeah. Namor the Depths, which is a weird book I picked up because it was $2.50 at Hastings, your entertainment superstore used.
It's so rad. We're really looking forward to talking about it.
We'll also have quick reviews of whatever the heck
comes up. So we'll be back next week. Crazy. I know we're back on a schedule. We're here. Listen to us next week. Thanks for tuning in.
Kennesaw Mountain Landis was a bad motherfucker. He was 17 feet tall. He had 150 wives. Didn't do that much except he saved a game of baseball. He put two and two together and he noticed it was four. Now the treachery of Shoeless Joe can't hurt us anymore. And he'll always be remembered as Kennesaw Mountain.